Narcissus Revisited. Wish not, but work. We need more than what we have. Let us be measured not for height or at the hip, but for our roles. Compensate us for compassion so we might look beyond our foyers with that rare and precious skill. I may not want, but many of my kind do. Women, hidden, squeezed, ignored, ridiculed, manipulated, raped, murdered. Pain, poverty, politics, all enemies' dark shadows, seaweed undulating beneath the sheen of the life I live. Even when I gaze deep and recognize algae there, feel their vile shapes, I do not recognize hubris lurking among them, women's worst foe. Those who feel new freedoms like I, some later borns unaware that they are new, accept the yellow bright shimmer spread across the surface as if it were our doing or our due. Acceptance works best when paired with gratitude. Why then do we forget what others did for us, what there is yet to do? Narcissus knows her own reflection well. She forgets to peer under burkas, in our jails, in the beds of the abused, deeper, deeper into the pond, beneath, where some still suffocate.
Welcome to Poets Cafe. Welcome, Carolyn Howard Johnson. We're so happy to have you here in the cafe today.
I'm really happy to be here, too.
This is Lois P. Jones, and we've just heard a fabulous poem from her collection, Deeper Into the Wood. This is called Narcissus Revisited. And Carolyn, you're a woman of so many talents and abilities, and we'll go into that. But we're going to start with your poetry, and this poem affected me in so many ways, especially today, you know, in our political environment. And I was looking at this particular line, "Let us be measured not for height or at the hip, but for our roles." And I thought about how this poem encompasses not only women's oppression, but acknowledging the road that we've come from and also raising our awareness that things still exist in this country.
Yeah. I worry that things have gotten so good in so many ways that we tend to ignore the fact that those strides need to be preserved.
Right.
And that although we hear it often, there's still work to be done. There's not a really deep consciousness of how much work still needs to be done.
Right. Well, we've come so long. I mean, you've seen different eras of how women have been treated over time, and yet we still have people like Aiken, who has that, you know, the type of ignorance where women are, what did he say, the state of legitimate rape, stating that a body has ways to shut the whole thing down.
That's kind of a reverse kind of a prejudice, too, kind of like we have magical cells or something that are just going to do these wondrous things. And, you know, I don't really want to be put on that kind of a pedestal. I believe that equality is equality for men and women.
Right.
And I don't need to be put on a pedestal. Just give me the true equality, the idea that we work together toward a common good.
Exactly. And it's incumbent upon our leaders, our congressmen, our people in government to raise their awareness about women, because women are voters. Women are part of
They seem to get that, but then sort of to ignore it.
I just can't believe anybody could get away with something like that. And this is also, you know, in part of your sensibility, I think, raising general awareness, political awareness. And I don't know if you would call yourself a feminist, but certainly a very strong...
Oh, well, I think not enough people admit to being feminists because so much has been done to tarnish that image, and it's so misunderstood. Yes, indeed, I'm a feminist, but It's not what we've been told feminism is or should be. It's what feminism really is, which is an interest in equality for both men and women.
Right.
My favorite feminists are men, including my husband.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, he supports you. And in supporting, I think we have to support one another rather than looking at some type of comparisons or a basis of strength. We're, as you said, you know, a position of equality, equality in the home, equality in our life, in our careers, in our pursuits, and in recognizing our both strengths of us as individuals, not only just as a particular sex.
Exactly, exactly. And without a false sheen put on it, the idea that we all do things the same.
Right.
And that we all have the same physical equipment. There are certainly individual differences, but there are also differences between the sexes.
Right.
So to ignore that is not to give us equality, but to teach us not to examine the truth.
Mm. Yeah, well, there's a lot of that going on.
That's
too.
For sure.
We just had a whole conversation
That's right.
about
we
that.
Just, we just fixed the world here, if only but.
And, you know, speaking of the power and empowering, a lot of what you do is very much geared toward enabling others, women and men, but also specifically women, I think, too, in what you do. Your role as an educator at UCLA, you teach, you have a marketing class that you teach, right?
Yeah, I've taught editing and marketing mm-hmm. in the writer's department at UCLA Extension.
Yes.
And really enjoyed it for almost a decade. I haven't done too much lately. I've been busy doing lots of other things. But
yeah, you do so
but
many
it's, I love my students and I love being on campus. It's wonderful.
It's a wonderful thing.
It feeds my soul. I like going back.
Let's go to a poem and then we can talk a little bit more about that. You have the next one.
Oh, you want that as a lead-in, don't
you,
Lois?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's such a great poem for that.
Well, actually, I wrote this just about the time I started writing and started realizing that writing and being published wasn't as simple as it had once been when you found a traditional publisher, the traditional publisher promoted for you, then you could go back to your writing.
Right.
So this one is called Demands Imposed Upon a Poet. And it starts with my general observation and leads into the very specific, some very specific events that happened when I was very young in Utah in the 1950s. Demands imposed upon a poet.
Okay.
Promotion versus art, the eternal cliché. Capture our essence, please. For a dust cover or miracle of miracles, the front page of poets and writers. If we appear ugly, then too damned bad. Coy hand against cheek, folded arms, no smile. Should we lean against some foreign tree? Fame magnifies pretense. A backlit fringe around Einstein's head is Boyle's curly halo. He, as brilliant in his way as the Big E, that wearing a metaphor he would surely reject if he were writing rather than posing. Or prose blemished the pulpy cover beneath her features, as if uneven texture improves literary skills. Kingston's smile secreted behind tight lips. I stowed a portrait like these in an album, unable to discard a memory. My face stares at me from a time before cameras saw color. Artificial tint on eyes and cheeks. The bra I didn't need peeks from under the corner of décolletage cut too deep. Another time I wear grandmother's gift, a top that exposes a keyhole of flesh where it buttons in the back. Mother insists upon an undershirt that showed there where my back should have been. 13 degrees. The winter of 49, snow shoveled high into igloo piles, knee-deep for adults, up to my newly emerging breasts. Alan sits behind me in class, pencil poised, traces the treads of that ghastly garment. I count minutes until the final bell. Flakes drift by the window. I feel Mother's ice in their drift, slowly, slowly. I know the winter will never thaw. Want to choose my own art or artifice, whatever that might be.
Fabulous. Thank you. You're listening to Poets Cafe on KPFK. I'm Lois P. Jones, and we're here with guest Carolyn Howard Johnson. She's just read this fabulous poem, Demands Imposed Upon a Poet, if you're listening in. You are one of the queens of promotion. You have evolved promotion, marketing, editing through your book series, best-selling book series, award-winning book series, The Frugal Editor, right? The Frugal Book Promoter. Mm-hmm. There are three or four in the series.
Yeah, a couple little books, little booklets that support that.
Right.
Yeah, it's a little series of books for writers.
Can we choose our own art or artifice as writers and promoters of our work? Can we do that?
You bet your life. Yeah, you know, we writers, whether we're poets or novelists or writers of nonfiction or even journalists, are living in the best time for taking control over our own careers.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Dickens was right. Is it Dickens? Maybe the worst of times, too, if I confused
him.
Yes,
Dickens.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Best of times.
See, I told you I don't memorize anything. but today when we're told no by someone else, we can actually do it ourselves.
Right.
And, of course, even when we're told yes, because the world is so big and there's so many different ways to reach people, one publisher just can't handle the branding of one artist, no matter how much money they put into it. And most are struggling a little bit at this point with their own bottom lines. So it falls on us as artists, regardless of the kind of artist we may be, to do a lot of our own branding of ourselves, branding of our work, and promoting of ourselves. And I hate the word shameless promotion because there's an unspoken part of that that says there's something to be ashamed of,
mm-hmm.
and there isn't.
Right.
We have always been branding and we have always been promoting ourselves. From the time we get up in the morning and comb the rat's nest out of our hair, mm-hmm. we are presenting an image to the world. So the trick is to get over that and start thinking of the real potential behind marketing, which is to consider others and then bring our work to those people we know will benefit from it. It isn't selling what they don't want. It's what they do want or what they need.
Right. And what you do, because this is who you are. One is a writer. And how are they going to get their work known in a vacuum? So it's incumbent upon us at some point to be able to get our words out there and find a way to make it interesting and not – I think people have a lot of confusion about those words, don't they? Marketing and promotion, it's sort of like I'm an artist and, you know,
yes,
this is for someone else.
Exactly. I'm a poet, not a promoter.
Right. And yet we see more and more writers and poets taking on that responsibility because, just as you said, the market dictates that. Publishers expect their writers to go out to do book tours, to do talk shows like Poets Cafe and KPFK, and other mediums.
You see even writer schools like UCLA's renowned extension program.
Right.
Bringing in people who can market to teach writers how to do it well. And I hope I've been instrumental in that. I think that the well part is extremely important. No one wants to have something shoved down their throat that they aren't interested in. And I'm certainly not interested in doing that either.
How do you get your students excited?
Oh, you know, if they're in my classroom, they're already excited.
They're like, we're with Carolyn.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to get the goods.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never had anyone walk out yet, but I have had students be very surprised.
Okay,
that they're going to have to do things That there's a choice, certainly, in how they promote, but they're probably going to have to learn to do things like write a media release. Mm-hmm. In the old days, we called them press releases.
Right.
Or put together a media kit, and that those are skills that they're going to need if they want somehow to get the word out about their new chapbook of poetry or their new novel or the fact that they're going to, that they're appearing on Lois P. Jones Poets Cafe and have people come listen,
right.
You know?
And do they need, I mean, is there always this desire to have an agent represent you ultimately as a writer? I know poets rarely have that opportunity, but we do sometimes have people represent us when we get to a certain point.
In some ways, poets are leaders in that direction,
yeah.
Because they have always been publishers of their own work, mm-hmm. through chapbooks.
That's right.
Since Elizabethan times or before.
Mm-hmm.
So they are leaders. What many don't quite get is that we can't spend... That some of that time we spend behind a computer still must be spent in getting the word out.
Right. I love in your book, you actually have in the frugal book promoter, you have broken down the definitions of each of the words. And you have frugal here, you know, economical in the use or appropriation of resources, not wasteful or lavish, etc. And so that's really important, isn't it? Because we have so much that we have to accomplish in our life. And how do we dedicate some of that time, you know?
Yeah, time and money. One of the things I hate the most is to see an author of any kind spend more money than they can ever make back on their book.
Right.
Or have the chance of making back on their book, and unless it's a hobby, and unless they're well aware that this is a budget that they want to spend, mm-hmm. and that this is fun for them, and this is what they want to do. But to go into spending a big budget on a lovely little poetry book called Imagining the Future, Ruminations on Fathers and Other Masculine Apparitions, when you know that not many men are going to be given a book of poetry for Father's Day.
Right.
It's the wrong audience. But I wrote it because it was in my heart. Still,
yes.
Still, we need to take those be practical. We need
yes.
to take those things into consideration. So if I'm going to spend a lot of money promoting it, then I'd better be darn well aware that that's going to be fun for me, that mm-hmm. I'm doing it from that standpoint as opposed to being hopeful about something that probably isn't going to happen.
Right.
So that doesn't mean one of the poems in it might not get famous. We constantly live with that hope, but...
That's right. In fact, we'll get to more of that, too, toward the end. I think there's a poem of yours. I love your poetry. I mean, I found myself torn in this interview going, shall we focus on Carolyn the poet, or shall we focus on Carolyn the educator and writer and you know, maven of marketing?
Well, you know, that's my problem, too. As a marketer, how do I brand?
Mm-hmm.
And which
yes.
of those brands is actually going to take over one of the other brands? And I hope that I can bring them together into sort of a single person. That's sort of a lesson that I'd like people who read my work to see that we aren't. None of us are just one character, one person.
That's right.
And certainly we do that when we write fiction. We're very careful to balance a character out. A villain who's pure villain mm-hmm. is usually not very interesting. You want to see some other side of them as well.
That's right.
Well, as authors, we want that too. And a lot of authors make the mistake of assuming that people only want to know about their work. And that's not true. Most people really want to know about the author.
You think so?
The author is part of the driving interest behind her work or his work.
You mean in some type of vague autobiographical sense?
Well, there wouldn't be a People magazine if that were true, is there? With her?
Right. So you're saying that some authors, well, I certainly know in poetry that's true. There's some essence of us. I was just thinking about this subject because sometimes people, you know, you've heard the line, write what you know. But it's not necessarily write from experience. It can be write the emotions you know. Because if you had a boring childhood and all you did was sit around and watch, you know, I don't know, TV or...
Yeah. Yeah, when I was first writing poetry, I was surprised to hear there was such a thing as a persona poem.
Right.
Well, where a poet puts him or herself into someone else's shoes mm-hmm. and writes from that point of view. That's very fiction-like.
Yes.
But I hadn't applied it to poetry, even as an English lit major. Mm-hmm. I hadn't applied that to poetry.
Right. So that in that sense that writing allows us to take on all these different aspects of ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, we love.
That's what makes it fun.
Yeah, that's what makes it fun. And all these different hats are part of the writer's responsibility. You're listening to Poets Cafe on KPFK. I'm Lois P. Jones, and my wonderful guest today is Carolyn Howard Johnson. And we've been running through so many areas, from poetry to promotion to the imaginings of our lives and how we integrate both sides, poetry and the need to get our work out there and get our word known. And Carolyn is an expert, I think, in both areas. And we're going to hear another poem from Carolyn, which is going to be...
This one is from my least selling chapbook. How's that for promotion?
Right.
It's called Grateful, the Last Lesson in Who He Was, Who I Should Be. And thank you for noticing this one, Lois, and asking for it. Not very many people do. Before the days of PCs, he kept books. I brushed silver webs from plank shelves he screwed into concrete walls above the desk he rescued from a demolition site. This is his office. Bent khaki filing drawers, a scratched black underwood for pecking out expense account records. Dim light from a narrow window in a foundation well, bare incandescent hung with a string. A metal tassel for an easy reach to light the early afternoons, when he'd sneak home to do his book work just before the winter sun weakened as it reached for the ochres about 4. Saved tribunes, posts, the hefty library dictionary full of 4-color pages of minerals and national flags that once waved above countries that no longer exist. But it was the National Geographics that surprised me, pages tagged with paper clips, pictures of Congolese women, brass rings around their necks, Abu's symbol being raised above a desert soon to be inundated, starry nights in Turkey, Watkins Glen, Chrysler Building. This message after he was gone, from a father who always said, with one of his famous grins, that there was nothing east of the Mississippi worth seeing anyway. How long it took me to decipher the code.
Mm, great poem.
That obviously written after my father died.
Yes.
And I was cleaning up his basement cave.
And he was, you know, from what I understood or reading your work, there was a mystery there because he disappeared after a certain time, didn't he?
He was always very private and living within a family that he didn't belong.
Mm-hmm.
His own family, and then he married out of his religion and his new family. In his new family, he was also sort of an isolated entity.
Interesting.
Which makes that office cave in the basement, in that unfinished basement, even more of a metaphor.
And, you know, we have these perceptions as children and then as adults. That's also the beauty of poetry, because we can discover these layers of our siblings, our parents, and we go, wow, this is a whole different world, right? And understand in some ways how he had that urge, really, to travel, that urge to, he was an adventurer in some ways.
Well, I think now that maybe he was making excuses because he couldn't really afford to take the family anywhere anyway.
Yeah.
So that was just a way to circumvent the truth, you know, that a denial thing that that we all have, or maybe something that he didn't even recognize in himself so much.
Right. But you have traveled very far, very east of the Mississippi.
Oh yeah, I took it from there, didn't I?
You did.
My mother would say I was obsessed, and I am. I love it.
And that's one of the beautiful things that informs your work. And must give you also a sense of balance, too, because you're so immersed.
Well, you know, I think I'm searching for that sense among human beings that we are as different as we are all the same. I'm trying to find it in cultures and places and countries and, against borders.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that that's one of the reasons I like to travel so much.
It's true. We connect. And we, I'm always amazed when I'm traveling how I meet somebody that I feel like, oh, I've known this person all my life. And how they're really, distance sort of disappears. And it is more and more through our travels and also through, of course, the internet and everything.
Yeah, it's a way if we did that more politically,
mm-hmm.
it could make a difference, I think, in coming to compromise as well.
That's true. I think every person in the United States should go outside of their borders, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And did you know I read somewhere that only 5% of our population has passports?
I was
dumbstruck. I was also very grateful that I'm one who does. But
yeah. I have friends that have never traveled without the vicinity of their city, which is just amazing to me because you grow so much as a person, as an individual through that.
Yeah.
And you also get a perspective on your own country, which we all need.
Yeah. I love talking. My husband and I do a lot of cruises, mm-hmm. and I'm always amazed at how many people, when they find out I'm from the United States, attack me to ask me questions.
Yes.
Because they know more about the United States than we know about them, generally speaking.
Right.
And they're aware that they don't have the full story.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
It's time. We're going to be going out now with one short poem.
All right.
We have two to choose from. Which one did you want
to? Let's do Woman to Woman,
okay.
As long as we were talking about my travels.
That one. Yes, yes, yes.
All right.
Perfect.
This was written after we had taken a trip down around the tip of South America. Woman to Woman. The women in these parts, ancient, twisted like Krumholtz near the tree line. This one, keeper of the cemetery, hunches against the perpetual gale, Arctic plague that has not ceased from Magellan's time to this. In this hemisphere's summer sun and wind, she shrivels a desiccated leaf. Even as she points out how beautiful the flowers, they are but wind-worn petunias on the graves. I tuck the label of my handbag under my arm, pull gloves over crude manicured nails, tell myself it is the southern chill. Her fingernails like bark, she points to the tomb of the unknown Indian boy, Punta Arenas Saint, savior of sick children. She reaches to stroke his bronze hand. Women believe in his touch. Una Pellegria. Hundreds of plaques nailed there, thanking him. Milagros de milagros. A child is saved. The keeper of the cemetery smiles. Teeth like stumps, eyes soft, as if she knows me.
As if she knows you, exactly.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for coming to our show. You've been listening to Poets Cafe with our wonderful guest, Carolyn Howard Johnson. You can find her books. Google her name. You'll find many of her works on Amazon. Her Frugal series is something that every writer wants to have, whether you're a poet or an author. Many thanks. Look for us on Facebook. I'm Lois P. Jones, and you've been listening to Poets Cafe on KPFK, Pacifico Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.